Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Today, we finalise a three-part Open House mini-series on ethics with the Reverend Dr. Andrew Cameron, ethics lecturer at Moore College. Andrew has kindly corralled some of his many ethical insights into a new book, A Joined-Up Life, A Christian Account of How Ethics Works. Andrew, welcome back to Open House. In the final chapters of your book, you take on what for many will be pretty challenging subjects around relationships, including same-sex marriage and euthanasia. Let's start with sex and the single person.
Yeah, I'm really keen to say something about that, and I'll just backtrack for a sec because I just wanted to observe the purpose of really all these last chapters. It's just that there are these things Christians do, which people find really strange, you know, really odd, and sometimes almost to the point of offensive, you know. And this is not new. Like, Christians in the early Roman centuries were accused of being, you know, baby-eating cannibals because they ate the flesh and drank the blood of the Son of God.
Yeah.
So it's always been incumbent upon Christians just to patiently explain back why we do what we do, at very least to show that we're not evil and insane. And that's sort of what these, even if I don't persuade everybody in these chapters, I'm just hoping they'll be able to read them and go, oh, okay, I get it now. So on singleness, in our culture, the idea that you would, you know, deliberately go through your life, you know, possibly as someone who's never had a sexual relationship, and you do that sort of on purpose, it strikes people as just mad, you know. It strikes people as ludicrous, you know. So what?
Unhealthy, even.
Indeed, that's right. Yeah. What I've tried to observe in this chapter is, firstly that, you know, Jesus was shocked everyone when in his time, you know, because they were as big into, you know, marriage at least back then as people have been ever since. And he said, well, there will come a time in heaven when marriage isn't the thing anymore. And that's just amazing to a married person to have this thought. But the reason he has this thought is because the Bible suggests that marriage is the intimacy of marriage is like a signpost to the intimacy people will have with the Father and the Son in heaven, you see. So this makes it really noble and possible for people to be single. And of course, back in the early centuries, being single meant you didn't have offspring, which was a disaster because you had no legacy.
Yeah.
And the early Christians went, well, hang on, if our inheritance is with God in heaven, a legacy becomes less important. And we can have a family now that we call brothers and sisters with our friends in church. You know, intimate relationships that aren't sexual but are still intimate and friendly with a whole swathe of people at church. So that's a really key point on singleness too. It's not about loneliness, okay? It's never good for people to be alone, but single people are, as it were, able to model for us what it is to have lots of close and supportive relationships where they care for many others that aren't defined by the ties of your genetics and your tribe, you see, because that's the only way we've slipped into our culture of having close relationships. It's all about your family and maybe your workmates, but they forget you the day you've left your workplace. So it's really just all about your family, right?
Yeah.
And we've been robbed of this, real witness that single people bring, that they can, there's a guy, he's celebrated among Christians, a fellow called John Stott, died recently. He was, he had thousands and thousands, literally thousands and thousands of people coming forward from all corners of the earth, you know, saying how much he had meant to them because he'd mentored them and he'd written to them and he'd given them all sorts of help and assistance and care and love over the years. And he was just a magnificent example of someone who was able to use his single status to build up and encourage many people, and he wasn't, you know, directed just by ties of kinship to do that, you know. So I hope that we can rediscover singleness as a noble thing, you know, a good thing, that married people need single people, very much, you know. Otherwise, we get stuck in our little view that our family is the be-all and end-all of everything.
Andrew, in that discussion, you touched on the purpose of marriage. What about the role of divorce?
I suppose divorce has become one of those phenomena that we just sort of take so for granted now.
Yeah.
That we forget that it represents we've smoothed over in some of the discourse around divorce that it is actually a tragic breakdown. You know, that the the grand hope for marriage was for it to be, a lifelong faithfulness.
Yes.
That grows and develops over time. I believe people have been a bit de-skilled in that lifelong element, and we've now got people sort of patching that up. You know, I heard the other day that there's people who talk openly in terms of, oh, she'll make a nice first wife for him, you know, as if it's kind of normal to go through and even encouraged in some quarters to go through, you know, two or three marriage partners in your lifetime. And I think that's, yeah, people often do this. When we just can't fathom how to make something work, we'll sort of reinvent it in this sort of patchwork way, you know. And you know, the Bible is in the business of saying we can do this. We can actually keep growing and rediscovering each other in the way that means that we can do lifelong faithfulness, you know. And that entails, you know, learning new things and growing through some pretty dark times in marriages. Maybe the problem has been we don't talk enough and make sense about the dark times, which aren't unique to any couple. Every couple has them, you know, and we can discover how to handle those differently.
But your contention is that there is still a place for that kind of separation.
Yes, because I think the reality is that, what can we do when... I've just painted what's my grand hope for every married couple, but for reasons that are probably mysterious, there are just times when people simply can't get through the dark times without, you know, there's just too much pain. And in the Bible, divorce is offered as a tragic concession to us at our weakest, you know. So it never sort of promotes divorce, but it offers it as what I've heard described as a retrieval. Epic meaning a moment in life where you seek for something that's less good when you can't have the best, as it were, you know, and the less good thing is that at least we can not be at war with each other if we're not living under the one roof, you know. And I think in my view is that the kind of divorce that Jesus really attacks is when you simply eye off someone else that you'd like and bust one marriage in order to go after the next partner. You know, he really hates that because that's just such an overt betrayal of what you said you'd do. But, and you know, apart from that, there's just this sad concession given to the need to not live in pain anymore.
Before we wrap up, we're going to touch on bioethics in a few moments' time, but let's talk a little more about relationships in the context of single sex and homosexuality. Is it your considered view, with all that's gone before in our discussions, that ethically we are called to live a lifelong of chaste singleness?
I think I'd have to... If I'm going to put my hand on my heart and say I'm reflecting what's taught in the Bible, they say that the two noble estates are faithful man-woman marriage that's open to children, and that's a key point. I think marriage that sort of deliberately avoids children, unless you've got a very serious extenuating circumstance, is problematic. Faithful man-woman marriage that's open to children or chaste singleness, that they're the two honourable estates that are put before us. Now, we live in a culture that... can't believe that because our culture loves all kinds of sexualized coupling. We think you're not a whole person if you're not in a sexualized couple, you see. And we've lost a lot of the kind of original understanding of marriage. We've split off child rearing from marriage. We've split off sex from child rearing. We've split off lifelong... lifelong from the companionship side of marriage. So it's become really difficult for our culture to believe that Christians aren't, well, evil and insane for suggesting that there are these two noble estates we're called into. So I want to be very gentle with people about this. I know this is hard to understand. I know that if you have a strong... friendship with a person of the same sex, you know, gosh, we're not against friendship, you know, but it's the way that our culture has come to believe that the friendship can't be kind of real or meaningful or complete unless it's sexualized, you know, that the Christians question, you know. There's probably a lot more to be said about that, but I want to just sort of keep gently putting the point that we're not... In a culture where people have come to all sorts of different views about this, we don't want to come across as you know, hating or rejecting anyone, it might not follow that we agree with everyone's take on how sexuality works, but we want to keep that dialogue open, I think.
Let's finish with bioethics. Euthanasia came before the New South Wales State Parliament recently. It was voted down, but it suggested that it'll get through again sometime fairly soon. And we're talking about the removal of life support here. What is the difference between euthanasia ethically and the removal of life support?
To get to the point where you realise that death has won, because we aren't immortal, and that a treatment is simply burdensome and that we won't keep offering a treatment, is qualitatively different to actively putting an end to someone's life. There's a Rubicon that you cross there. Now, some philosophers want to persuade us that what I've just said isn't true, that there's no distinction between those two things, but I reckon people in healthcare, it might be a little bit of a blurry line, but it's still a line, you know, and to commit ourselves to a regime where we have currently a best practice in hospitals in New South Wales at the moment is you don't, people are free to choose not to receive treatment if they think it's burdensome, and we don't have to give burdensome treatment. That's best practice, you know. But there's you've crossed into a different terrain entirely when it's okay to deliberately shorten someone's life. Because what you actually do is you're going to start pulling the struts out from under all the reasons why we care for people at their weakest if you do this. The proponents of euthanasia, I think, ironically, are eternal optimists, because they always say, oh, no, we'll get it through next time. Now, what actually always happens is when you ask people in a five-second conversation, should we have euthanasia? Oh, yeah, sure. There was a famous phone survey done 5 years ago. It's always quoted by the pro-euthanasia lobby that 87% of people are in favour of euthanasia. What this was a single question survey that was, you know, done by a marketing company where they called and asked a very loaded question: if the situation is hopeless and someone's in incredible pain, would you give a drug to end it all? And, you know, people who are bathing the kids and making dinner and getting this phone call go, oh yeah, sure. But you put people in a focus group for 2 hours, get them to think through the implications, the opposite happens. People all go, oh no, actually it's a really bad idea for our society. You know, so, and this happens every single time. Whenever a euthanasia, and it pops up like, it's like whack-a-mole, you know, they pop up every 2 to 5 years. Everyone goes, oh yeah, it sounds like a really good idea, it'll solve all sorts of problems, it'll cut healthcare costs, it'll mean that people aren't in pain anymore, blah blah blah. And then we look at it, and the devil really is in the detail. And like all good ethics, you work out a better way of solving the problems, which is good palliative care, making sure that that people are nurtured through the process of dying, because that's often what's driving this. People are scared of death and they don't know what to do. There's just much better ways to solve end-of-life issues than a euthanasia regime.
We accept that there's the sanctity of life, but what about the sanctity of the quality of life? I can't bear to see my loved one be diminished in this way.
Yeah, there's two problems with this strain. The first is, underneath that is the view that you're only as good as what you're capable of performing, right? You're only as good as what you, as how independent you can be, how kind of muscular in the world you can be. And any diminishment of that is something we've all got to consider such a tragedy that the person shouldn't go on. And so that leads us to the second problem. Where does that leave people with disability? You know, once you start thinking like that, you've actually creating a world where people with disability have always got to prove to the world why it's okay for them to be here.
Yeah.
Okay, going back to your little scenario, what would be better is if we interrogated our sadness at that point. I can't bear to see my loved one diminished. Yeah, you're really sad. This is a really sad thing that's happening. Let's talk about your sadness and learn what that is. You know, and one of the things that I think is so hard for folks who look after people at the end of life as families, who come in and they're just in a panic because they haven't even begun to think about the fact that they're sad, you know? And this is the first time they've been confronted with something that everyone else in the world has known since time immemorial, that folks grow old and die, and it is really sad. But it doesn't follow that we should kind of... I don't think actually euthanasia is about ending the life of the other person sometimes. It's actually about euthanizing our sadness, you know, making sure that we don't have to be sad for very long. And a better way would just be to, you know, watch ourselves at that point.
Andrew, in your writing of the book, were there any moments where you reconsidered your position on any of these chapters?
Well, Yes, I think in the sense that it became increasingly obvious to me that, very clearly, we're in such a pluralist society that I think we need to be a little bit more winsome and a little bit more easygoing about how we put our case. Yeah. Right? And it's not just Christians at this point, actually, but one of the problems with our pluralist society, which is not all bad, actually. I'm sort of in favour of pluralism in some respects, a little chapter on diversity there.
Yes, yes.
The problem with it is we've all been a bit robbed of the capacity to have our conflicts, which is about what matters, but to have them in a way where we're friendly and not anxious, you know. And one of the things that really saddens me about Australia at the moment is just how revved up everybody is all the time about everything, and we try and paper this over with how casual and tolerant and friendly and relaxed we are. We're just not. We're really anxious, uptight people, you know? And a lot of this is coming out with Christians, you know, because we're feeling a bit marginalised and we're feeling a bit like a lot of things are going to, it's going to the dogs, as it were, you know, and we speak about it angrily, you know? So one of the things that I'm hoping that people can do is think of themselves as more like, sort of happy subversives, joyful subversives in the culture. What is it to be in a culture where a lot of people believe differently from you, and you're still signalling that you care? You're not able to change everything overnight. You're not going to ever persuade some people. But what is it to keep joyfully signalling that we've got a different view that is actually helpful to others, but we're not against them, that we're with them in the offering of it, you know? And this, I think, is urgently needed, because a lot of Christians have either gone underground or just come across as really angry. and we don't have to settle for either, you know?
Yeah.
I hope, you know, I guess what came through to me is being a bit more, I don't know what the right word is, I suppose a bit more relaxed around people who think very differently to me, while not thinking that it follows that I have to abandon my view just because they don't agree with me.
It was a joyful journey. Thank you for taking it with us. Thank you for leading us through it, Andrew.
Thanks, Dwayne.